Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-hosts Tom Coffeen and Scott Hoag. And today, you're getting the three of us because we want to talk about IP addresses, just addresses. And specifically, we want to talk about, it sounds strange on a V6 show, but we want to talk about IPv4 special addresses. And so for many of us, V4 special addresses really falls into the RFC 1918 is the classic first RFC, I think, that everyone sort of learns about reserved address spaces for like private addresses. But there's actually much later a bunch of updates around RFCs, and those original RFCs were things like 3330, and the current ones are 5736, RFC 6890, and RFC 8190.
Ed, is there going to be a quiz at the end of the podcast?
There is a quiz on all the RFCs. You have to be able to cite them and include all the addresses that are in each one of them individually, so each breakdown.
Oh, crud. Do I get a certification at the end of the process?
No, but we will be happy to send you a sticker. But the interesting part about this is sort of where this all came from and why V4 has all these special addresses. And it turns out V6 has some special addresses too, so we can definitely pivot and talk about those. But I thought it was interesting to talk about this because of one of the articles that we actually ran across recently talking about the Linux kernel trying to redo some of the special address space. And we'll get to that in a moment, but maybe we cover a little bit of background and we talk about what actually is in the special address range.
So I guess for the listeners at home, we can talk about if I wanted a quick and dirty resource for where to track down all these special addresses, what would I use? Because I don't want to go pouring through the RFCs.
IANA has a page that's available for assignments, and they actually list out all the IPv4 special registry addresses. There's a whole list of special addresses that come from all the different RFCs. And the classic ones everyone knows on RFC 1918 is the 10.0.0/8 for private use, and then the 192.168.0/16, and the 172.16.0/12. I think those are the ones that like every network engineer that commonly off the top of their head is going to know like right away. Then there's some oddball ones about like documentation prefix, right? So the documentation prefix ones are a little less known. The 192.02.0/24. Everyone's like, what?
Yeah, that's right. And I learned the IPv6 documentation range first, 2001 right. :db8:32. And only after having learned that, discovered that there was an IPv4 documentation range. I'm like, what? I never knew about this. Where did this come from?
There's additional ones.
Yeah, that's right.
Besides the 192, there's the 198.18.0/24. I don't know where in the world they got these breakdowns. These
right. And so the real question is, how often have you seen these addresses in production networks being used?
Well, the documentation ones I actually haven't very commonly seen being used. I have seen them used in some documentation, like people actually that have looked it up, have looked up those particular range sets and said, oh, I'm supposed to write documentation with them. Most of the time, I will be honest, the documentation I see written is in using RFC 1918 address space. They're mm-hmm. using 10 dot or, you know, the 192.168 dot or the 172.16 dot address space to be able to document or build out sample networks.
Well, right, because you don't really have like enough prefix space, right, to be able to depict larger like WAN scale networks with the documentation ranges. This is a problem with IPv6 with the documentation range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you know, and maybe you're fine with the /32 and you can carve up the prefixes from /32, but maybe you have a larger network you'd like to depict. And no, but I guess I was asking, will stacks actually route the documentation range of addresses? And I think the answer is yes, right? And then do they actually show up in folks' networks occasionally? Like, you know, we hear stories about let's take another address 1.1.1.1, you know, historically, and of course now it's got a different purpose altogether, but historically using it for documentation purposes, or maybe it even shows up in a production network.
Cisco wireless LAN controllers, I think almost universally they always set up 1.1.1.1 on the controller for redirecting for the capture portal. I just think it's really fascinating. There's a tremendous amount of address space that's obviously, you know, special or reserved. I think the big one that a lot of folks point to is the 240. What used to be, you know, if you're really old, like the three of us, you remember class A, class B, class C, D, and E. And the E space was a special reserve for, you know, research projects. It was supposed to be like, hey, you know, you're doing something skunk works out there and you want to be able to do something interesting for research purposes. We set aside a huge swath of address space, the 240.0.0.0/4. So it's a big range. reserved specifically for that. And you know, today it's just not used. The challenge really becomes, like, even though it's available, it's you know, clearly something available from an address range because it's reserved out. You just don't know how people have written code, right, across the internet for, you know, routers and switches and host operating systems about how they'll behave if they get a 240 address. Is it something actually usable on a host? Is it something actually routable on a device or not? And I think that's part of the challenge that specially assigned addresses, did they actually make it into silicon, or are they only in software, or, you know, where is the limitations around the addresses themselves? One of the special ones is the 169.254.0.0/16. That's a link local address for V4. That's an APIPA address, right? It's a sort of the self-assigned address. Everyone I know who works on networks, the moment they see a 169 address, it's like the first indication is my network is broken.
that's right. You get all sad. You see 169.254. Oh, I'm not on the network.
It's my EC2 instance metadata.
That's true. That's exactly right. I need to do a metadata query. So what do I ask my link local address for the metadata related to that EC2 instance? And it's, to me, you know, for most operators, they see the 169, they're like, that means my DHCP server is working right now. that's how they troubleshoot. So it's sort of funny, even though it's actually designed to be used as a link local address. And the other famous one is obviously the 0.0.0.0/8, which is what this article was published and all about. And we'll put the article in the show notes for folks that want to go ahead and read it. But basically, folks are doing a submission in the Linux kernel to basically free up the 0.0.0.0/8 address space, as opposed to the /32 specific 0 space address, right? Which is sort of interesting and saying, like, hey, we should be able to use the, you know, 16 plus million addresses that exist in that range. We should be able to have those as globally routable addresses. The only one that we can't use is the actual 0.0.0.0.0, like specific 32, right? And so it becomes this interesting debate, like, will the internet actually even allow that to happen? And then how many devices would that actually break if it was implemented that way? And there are other address spaces that fit in this similar category. I think the 240, the original class C 240.0.0.0/4 is one of them that they're also looking at very heavily. And maybe the multicast address space too, 224.
So what problem are they trying to solve with this approach? I mean, because there's some intuitive answers that seem correct in answering that question, but I don't know that I trust my intuition on this. What problem do you think that they're trying to solve, and how are they looking at that problem over the long term to justify making such a change?
Yeah, I guess the argument is that the time horizon for V6 adoption has taken far too long, and the time horizon for how long V4 is going to be around before rapid adoption of V6 is happening is a problem, and therefore they need to find more address space in the V4 space, more global, quote-unquote global unicast equivalent address space, or more routable public V4 address space to free up to allow people to be able to continue to operate at scale on the internet. I just don't know if freeing up a /4 or even 2 /4s and a /8 is going to really help, you know, the backbone of the internet in terms of global scale for additional addresses in any meaningful way. There's been articles from AP Nick and from Aaron that basically say that it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much space we sort of free up out of the existing pools. The requests they're getting on a per month basis just far strips or exceeds that capacity requirement.
So then I guess the other question that goes along with that then is that there must be some lack of confidence that they can effectively deploy IPv6 to solve whatever problem that they're running into based on a lack of address space that would compel the use of one of these special use ranges, or, you know, 0/8, modifying the kernel to support that. That's really the mystery to me. It's like, what use case are you thinking of where it wouldn't be solved by just using IPv6?
Yeah, I guess it's just the stubbornness of enterprises not wanting to convert or adopt V6. I don't know a good, I mean, obviously we're entirely biased. Being V6 people, it's like, what is the issue? Like, hurry up.
We're drunk on our own Kool-Aid here, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like, it's, you know, you're asking the wrong person. Maybe we need to get Greg on the podcast to wave the V4 flag for us. I don't know. I think it's interesting. Maybe it's simply just, you know, there's a certain set of momentums around IPv4 that have solved
that have been solved and they feel much more comfortable in that space versus V6? I don't know if I have a good articulated answer around that.
One of the things is if they free up this space and they make it, you know, they take it from being this host on its network address to a unicast address, then wouldn't the ICANN need to allocate it to one of the five regional internet registries?
Yes.
Look, it's unicast address space. So which RIR is getting 0/8?
Yeah. Who wants to deal with that? I suppose that's the same question as that. Let's talk really quickly, go back to 1.1.1.1, which Cloudflare had to clean up in order to be able to advertise both 1.0.0.1 and 1.1.1.1. Let's say that 20 times really quickly. But you know, there's a whole set of challenges of scrubbing. There's some pretty interesting presentations out there if you folks are interested, looking at what Cloudflare had to do in order to actually free up and sort of say, like, what's the impact of us turning on a service on this address, and what are we going to see coming at us, you know, as we advertise this and make this publicly available on the IPv4 internet.
Yeah. I think you'll see a lot of backscatter, because I think all of these addresses are perfectly valid as a spoofed address in the source. If you use those as your spoof source, you'll see backscatter coming back at you when it is freed up to be legitimate. I mean, that's, I think, one of the things we talked about on our previous shows, where we talk about IPv4 address transfer market, is the price of a, quote, clean address versus a dirty address that's on a block list. And these addresses definitely are on anti-spoofing lists. And like you said, Ed, that could be built into software or hardware.
Yeah. And how do you effectively rehabilitate these addresses for use? I mean, obviously, if they're isolated within an enterprise, then, you know, maybe it's not an issue. But then the question becomes, well, if you're within an enterprise and none of this is really routed, then, you know, you can use anything. It doesn't really make a difference. But how do you, so from a security perspective, Scott, I think that's an incredibly important point. You have all these addresses that are part of baked in security policy that's been established over years and years, and all sorts of gear that you have programmed into ACLs, looking for these addresses, dropping them at the edge or wherever in the network that the traffic is being looked at. How do you rehabilitate these addresses to actually use them? And is that going into the consideration of, hey, let's just throw some more IPv4 addresses at this problem, you know, and delay adopting IPv6?
Yeah, it's not like, you know, it's easier to add a TLV or something to your favorite routing protocol and extend it in some way, you know. Well, to do that, yeah, it's an RFC, and then you need implementers to implement it. Then you need all the code to get upgraded across the entire internet, you know, to make that happen. Same thing here. Or let's poke fun at IPv6. Extension headers. They were meant to allow extensibility of the protocol, but let's say you wanted to add your own, you know, Tom Coffin extension header,
yes,
the TC extension header. What would you have to add? How many middle boxes would you have to touch to enable the TC extension header? Because all those middle boxes have been scared about IPv6 security, and they're blocking all these extension header packets.
Well, that's sad. My extension header is not going to make it through the network, is it?
No.
I mean, it could be a routing header, though. I think you could add a TC routing header.
Okay.
See, mine is so close because it's almost EF. It's EA.
EF.
It expedited poorly.
Expedited early extension header. It's a EHEH. So,
well, I say SRH, segment routing header, Scott Russell Hoag.
Perfect.
That's a coincidence or not?
Relay it down.
Tom Coffin addressable memory. Sorry, I had to get that out.
So, what's interesting to me around sort of the address space is exactly to the point that Scott brought up, which is, how many bogon lists that people haven't touched or updated are existing out there as ACLs that are like, oh, we took the well-published bogon list of, you know, the original RFC 3330 and then all these updates afterwards. All these addresses are sitting out there in block lists. Like, this is clean internet route filtering. You should see none of these addresses coming to you from the internet. And if everyone was doing clean hygiene, then it might actually be possible that route advertised some of these, because everyone would be like, okay, we're introducing net new ones. You should update your list. But unfortunately, the world doesn't work that way. And we see a lot of exploits that come from these sourcing addresses because, exactly to Scott's point, they're great to use as a spoofing source address.
Right.
To say, hey, you know, this is where we're coming from. I think there's a lot of challenges that are going to happen for folks that adopt this, even internally within their network, because suddenly from a route perspective, if things come in from the outside and you're saying, hey, those are legitimate addresses on the inside, that means you're going to be forwarding it to the inside, right? Mm-hmm. And saying like, hey, this is legit traffic. And then off to the races you go, it turns into something where it's like, oh, well, we do have quote unquote that source. So you could denial of service yourself if someone's coming inbound and you don't have the right filters, and then you're forwarded to yourself internally for these addresses. Suddenly you're responding back to yourself.
God, it seems like just a whole lot of additional complexity and introducing additional technical debt. If only there was another address protocol that we could use instead of trying to use these IPv4 addresses.
Yeah, because the amount of effort, you're right, Tom, the amount of effort you would put into rehabilitation, changing stacks, not just of the end host, but of middle boxes and routers. Wouldn't that time be spent doing something else that really moves the ball forward in another area?
If only there was an address protocol like that.
Like with a really large, globally unique address space that doesn't overlap. You know,
so you guys are talking about IP version 10? Is that
or fifth octet IPv4?
Right,
which is just adding another octet. And how hard could that be? Like to add that, I'd have to recompile the kernel. Let me think about that. Yeah. might take a while to do that. I might just do something else.
Well, to me, this feels like, and maybe my analogy is off, but I always envision when we're talking about V4 versus V6 and just in pure address space, I feel like we're sitting around with a bunch of straws in a 55-gallon drum. And everyone's gathered around this drum. And we got these long straws and we're trying to find these small pockets of like whatever fresh water's left over in a 55-gallon drum. And we're all sitting up in Lake Tahoe and it's like one of the world's largest freshwater bodies is sitting immediately to, you know, your left, and all you have to do is pick your straw up and go stick it in Lake Tahoe for V6. And I just don't understand why everyone wants to still hang around the 55-gallon drum, except for maybe it's just cool to hang around the 55-gallon drum. I don't know. But that's how it feels to me. And in many ways, trying to make these, you know, while granted legitimate addresses from a V4 perspective, these special reserved ones that were, you know, these decisions were made a long time ago back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, many of them in terms of allocations, and trying to dig them up again and make them useful for certain purposes just seems to be, that small case of like, okay, I got another droplet of water at the bottom of this 55-gallon drum, who gets to use their straw? But it's quite clear that there's a lot of people that are interested in it because it's moving forward in terms of, you know, Linux kernel development. And to their credit, it's something like only 3 or 4 line changes for each address to actually, you know, re-enable it and turn it on. Apparently it's not huge changes in the Linux kernel in terms of code structure. It's really much more of a thing around operational principle, at least in my mind's eye, of like, is this going to be useful for us? And instinctively, at least my head's telling me no, but I don't know, I could be proven wrong on this one, and it could be, you know, could be the saving grace for V4.
And we have seen examples of special use addresses being deployed, you know, effectively as a stopgap measure by very, very large content companies, the 100.64 space as an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, so why don't we talk about that one really quickly, because probably not a lot of people know what 100.64.0.0/10 is actually for and what it's all about.
Yeah, what was it reserved for originally?
It was reserved for this like carrier grade NAT, in a sense, where a service provider could use this address space inside their network. It wouldn't overlap anything else a customer might be doing. They could safely translate a public address in back into this special, you know, address space, and then the shared address space, rather RFC 6598, and then re-NAT it again to public IPv4 address space used on the internet. So like a NAT 444. Is how I think it was intended.
Yeah, just give you super big space, right? Because it's they needed it for that translation mechanism. They effectively ran out of RFC 1918 space. They needed to be able to NAT again, right, to free up space around that. So it's sort of a scaling issue for those. But because it's shared address space, it's shared commonly among this. It's at least my understanding for service providers, it was going to be shared common space amongst the service providers to understand, like, hey, you know, we're using this, but the point of this space is really for transition purposes. That was also my understanding for one of the goals with it. It was transition purposes to get to V6. It's pretty common, you know, for service providers to be expected to use this address space to accomplish some of that. I think the oddball thing is we've seen a couple bigger players use it for entirely different purposes, right?
Exactly. Netflix in particular, right?
Yeah, Netflix has given presentations at AWS reInvent about, you know, their use of VPCs and the addressing they use. And they use this in their AWS VPC infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I guess you could consider Netflix in that category of sort of that size and scope from a sort of a content provider. Mm-hmm. If you look at what they're building, maybe it makes sense for them to really use this address space. But I do feel like it's one of the unknowns. And like, if you were to go around and talk to enterprises and be like, hey, what did you know? You have another slash 10 that you can use. They'd all be running for this address space to utilize. And one of the reasons why is because they have that much fear about deploying IPv6. And it's sort of an interesting psychological thing. Like, how much more address space can we get? How much can we continue running away from that, you know, related issue. And I feel like that would be one of the things that would happen pretty commonly. So I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing a lot more of that appearing out there. And I think the same thing would happen if, for instance, maybe IANA decides that 0.0.0.0/8, while it's fine for them to make the modifications in the Linux kernel, they don't want to make it a globally routable address, mm-hmm. then people are going to start using it like the equivalent of an RFC 1918 space, right? And saying, well, we're going to self-assign then, we're going to use it for that, and then we're just going to NAT to allow us to have more addresses, quote unquote, within our private network. It prolongs the pain and the technical debt that we are going to take on versus just the adoption of V6. At least in my mind's eye, that's how I see it.
Yeah, well, I agree. And so then I'm thinking, why are we talking about this? As an IPv6 commissar, I feel now I'm going to have to go back and scrub any mention of these ranges that enterprises shouldn't be using, and just replace it with a loud voice with a klaxon behind it saying, just deploy IPv6.
Yeah, I don't think we're doing ourselves a disservice. I mean, the reality is that these are all published and available. People right. can read them in the RFC.
Sure. Sure. Well, and Scott, you know, you've made this point before on multiple occasions. It's like, you know, just because you can deploy IPv6 and you should deploy IPv6 and solve the address resource issue for yourself, it's not as if you don't have requirements, ongoing requirements, to still have IPv4 on the network. And in some cases, you need addresses. And in the instance where it's a stopgap measure to get you operationally through the immediate weeds to get to the place where you can, you know, really deploy IPv6 in earnest and then slowly get IPv4 off your network, then of course you should take advantage of the resources that are available. But it shouldn't be used as an excuse, as you mentioned earlier, Ed, to just continue to ignore IPv6 while the rest of the internet moves on without you and deploys IPv6 at scale.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, we've talked about this on a number of shows. Moving to dual stack is not where you win. Where you win is V6 only. Mm-hmm. Then you completely don't have to worry about V4 or anything else.
Or run V4 as a service over V6. Mm-hmm. You may still have V4 requirement sets, but you're able to isolate them, put them in the right sort of contained boundary and say like, okay, we don't have to expand what we do anymore around V4. So we put that stopgap. We no longer have that resource requirement hanging over our head. And we continue to expand with V6 because we've got plenty of capacity to be able to do that. And then we're very cautious and much more measured about how we deploy V4 because it's a V4 as a service over the top. And you can allocate, you know, 32s everywhere, right? So, that specific address to that specific service. And mm-hmm. and you're going to control the burn rate that you require for V4. I think that's a good strategy for many enterprises. Well, hey, I think we should have as another subject us talking about the special V6 addresses. We'll save that for another show. But unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. Thanks for listening. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6Buzz. And you can also hit up each of us on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6Tom. Scott Hoag is at Scott Hoag. And Ed is me. I'm at Hugh Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. And please check out all the other great technical content over at the Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.